And welcome back. Up next, one of the most original thinkers of our time. He's been on the program several times before, always generates a great deal of controversy, but more than that, intrigue and mystery, and certainly encourages people to think about things in ways they had, in many cases, never even considered before. He is Michael Tesourian. He's back with us tonight in light of the story that came out early last week from a Canadian scientist and a couple of others, not just one scientist, in fact, a group of them, and other thinkers and researchers and folks who spend a lot of time pondering, as it were, that the human DNA is full of a lot of genes that probably didn't naturally arise on this planet. They're called alien genes, and Michael has a good deal to say about this and other things, as he always does, and so let's welcome him back to the program. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Jeff. It's nice to be back with you.
How are you?
Very well, and it's great to hear your voice.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate the kind words. How are your alien genes doing tonight?
It's incredible, isn't it? And, of course, this is just one of, you know, it's of many stories. It's
indeed
very difficult to, it's just, yeah. I think the magnitude of this is stands out, of course, but, you know, I'm being sent information from all over the world about even scientists, you know, at the top of the totem pole doing this kind of research, completely leveling, which is what we, people like us, have known, that every 5 years science has to level, you know, so much of what it was saying, mm-hmm. because it's a propaganda mm-hmm. machine. But even laying that aside, mm-hmm. you know, there's so many more discoveries. I mean, you know, I'm working on the Irish Origins book.
Oh, yeah, you know, of course.
And we've got, you know, that even recently there's been tremendous discoveries there. They're finding Caucasian people. Another burial site has been found frozen in Russia. That's, again, causing all sorts of upheavals of the concept of the migration of the tribes. They found these Caucasian-type mummies, you know, where they never expected them before.
Indeed. They found some of those in Western China, in
That's
fact.
Right.
Frozen Caucasian mummies with red
yep.
hair.
Do you know that they've just discovered another one, a very important one? It's a Russian archaeologist has discovered it in Altai, in the Russian province. And this character has blonde hair, you know, has the tattoos, and he definitely was a person of advanced. It's not just, okay, yeah, we found a body, hey, fantastic.
Right.
It's that wherever they find these people, they find on them either jewelry that shows that they were very sophisticated, agricultural implements, say they're buried, for instance, in a, you know, a proper funerary site. Then what happens is they're not only surprised to find the body, they're surprised to find the sophisticated accoutrements that go in the funeral, which, you know, rival Egypt, which show up right. very sophisticated cultures. So it's not just about finding some guy frozen in the snow somewhere. It's all that comes with that, not just the positioning, but all the other accoutrements that show the civilization.
Right. Well, when they find one with a cell phone, we'll have a hell of a story here.
Man, I tell you, it's just great because of, you know, this information is getting out, and by the way, of the internet, under the radar, so to speak.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of dysfunction within the so-called, you know, academic science world, and people are now starting to not buy in as much as they did before.
Well, dysfunction is being kind. There's that withering, ruthless attack on anyone who attempts to really subvert or change or alter or even push in a new direction. They don't like
That's right.
that. They want the status quo. They want tomorrow and next
yeah.
year to be pretty much like today. They don't touch the sacred cows, or your funding is cut off and your career
yeah.
is finished and all the rest of it.
Yeah, so. I mean, this is a very key thing, and it's troubling for them because, you see, then they have people on the outside who, you know, who won't give up, who are the mavericks, who keep pushing, you know, the envelope, and who do find out radical things without a budget, you know, without all the red carpets and all of the different they don't jump through hoops, you know, the Velikovskys of the world and others.
True.
You know, many people you have on your show, they're working this stuff out, Morris Cotterill, you know, I mean, the list goes on.
Well, and Tesourian as well, let's not forget you, my friend, because you've been doing as much as anybody to make noise and to push a new direction, so, yeah I agree.
Well, thank you, you know, and it's just something I love, I have the love to do it, you know, it's not something that ever is considered a chore to me.
Right.
You know?
You have as much passion in you as any three or four researchers, and that's quite a compliment given by anyone, and I'm very proud to lay it on you tonight, because you do.
Well, you know, the way I look at it is we've been shot out here for a very long time. We have a Leviathan to take down, and, you know, this is not something that is to be taken lightly. We've always been under attack, you know, from our so-called hidden masters. And, you know, this problem goes on. It has many forms. And, you know, I'm not a person who will rest until something is done about it. You know, and if even if that can mean the awakening of just one other person,
right?
You know, that so be it.
All true. One at a time. We'll take it. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But most important thing is, and you found this out early on, there are a lot of people who just don't want to know or are not capable of knowing, and you got to recognize those people and say, have a good day and get on to someone who's able. Now, you can't deal with those people.
Yes, I'm very happy, you know, on the blog that I have and just the amount of, you know, kudos. I sent a large chain mail to over, I don't know, must have been in the region of between 5,000 and 7,000 people,
mm-hmm.
this particular article that you're referring to about the DNA.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm hit back not only by, hey, thanks for sending that's incredible kind of emails, but also people saying, hey, and listen to what I found in my area. This corroborates what has just been discovered here. So it's not people just responding with dumb eyes going, oh, what was this all again? Remind me. It was people, you know, saying, hey, yeah, this connects with what is, you know, discoveries are being made, or I heard about this. So there's a tremendous feedback, which is so good, because otherwise you'd be thinking that you're in the dark.
You know, well, true.
And we have to always remain positive to think that we do have more, you know, freedoms in certain ways of thought than we've ever had before in the feudal times when it was much more difficult to ask questions, when it was prohibited. We have a little bit of a rare opportunity in this world to really do our homework, to get passionate about things, and to take responsibility for the lives we live, where we absolutely simply just couldn't do it before, when the Baron and the Lord was the one telling you how you were going to live. So there's no time like the present to be changing, you know, the status quo in life, because we have that extra leverage. But as you say, there's some people who are absolutely not, you know, joining that and are refusing. And in their complicity, they're not just sitting on the fence, they're actually aiding and abetting the forces of, you know, control, basically.
And the forces of control have become masters at using that kind of mentality and mindset at no expense to themselves at all. It's true. Here's the story, for those of you who may have missed it and who may not know what we're talking about here. And the headline is, Scientists Find Extraterrestrial Genes in Human DNA. And the subtitle is, Do Civilizations of Advanced Human Beings Exist Scattered in the Galaxy? And I'll read a little bit from the text here to set the stage. A group of researchers working at the Human Genome Project, it's a pretty prestigious group, by the way, folks, in case you don't know, indicate that they made an astonishing scientific discovery. They believe so-called 97% non-coding sequences in human DNA is no less than genetic code of extraterrestrial life forms.
Isn't that amazing?
It is. Let me read that again. This is an interesting direct cut and paste from the news story, but they left a couple of words out of it. I read it this time. They believe that the so-called 97% of non-coding sequences in human DNA, that's not 97% of all the DNA, that's 97% of the non-coding sequences in DNA, is no less than the genetic code of ET life forms.
Mm-hmm.
The non-coding sequences are common to all living organisms on Earth, from molds to fish to human beings. In human DNA, they constitute the larger part of the total genome. This says Professor Sam Chang, the group's leader. Non-coding sequences, originally known as junk DNA, were discovered years ago, and their function remained a mystery. The overwhelming majority of human DNA is off-world in origin, says Professor Chang. The apparent extraterrestrial junk genes merely enjoy the ride, with hard-working active genes passed from generation to generation. After comprehensive analysis, with the assistance of other scientists, computer programmers, mathematicians, and other learned scholars, Professor Chang had wondered if the apparently junk human DNA was created by some kind of extraterrestrial programmer. The alien chunks within human DNA, Professor Chang further observes, have its own veins, arteries, and its own immune system that vigorously resists all our anti-cancer drugs. Now that, Michael, is a strange statement. I'm not sure I understand what Professor Chang was speaking about there, unless he was talking metaphorically. Do you understand?
No, you see, it's not just metaphorical. It's Orwellian doublespeak. in many, it's a very subtle form. It's, these kinds of statements are loaded. They have many levels of meaning. Mm. He is at one point pointing out just the physical discoveries that they've made, that you know, the DNA has all of these different kinds of properties.
Right.
That they didn't know about. I mean, you know, DNA, it's been known that DNA has lots of different kinds of properties they never knew about. But there's a whole other subtext going on in these kinds of statements that we also need to be very, very conscious of when these people are dropping such kinds of words like programmer.
Got it.
You know, we're human beings. We're not machines. So even the very usage of the word, Jeff, you know, programmer or, you know, the big code or extraterrestrial programmers is already sending us a negative message about, you know, the man-machine.
Understand. Okay, I
dichotomy,
follow
you. You know?
Yeah, good. All right. Back in a minute, we'll read a little bit more from this story and continue our conversation with Michael Tesarian. Michael Tesarian. Professor Chang further stipulates that, quoting now, our hypothesis is that a higher extraterrestrial life form was engaged in creating new life and planting it on various planets. Earth is just one of them. Perhaps after programming, our creators grow us the same way we grow bacteria in petri dishes. We can't know their motives, whether it was a scientific experiment or a way of preparing new planets for colonization. Or is it long-time, ongoing business of seeding life in the universe itself? Professor Chang further indicates that, quote, if we think about it in our human terms, the apparent extraterrestrial programmers were most probably working on one big code consisting of several projects, and the project should have produced various life forms for various planets. They have been also trying various solutions. They wrote the big code, executed it, did some like function, and then changed them or added new ones. Executed again, made more improvements, tried again and tried again. Well, Michael, so far they haven't gotten this experiment right yet, and I'm certainly not going to be the last one to stand up and say it's time for a genetic shift. We killed over 120 million of our own kind in wars in the last century alone, and we're off to a pretty raunchy start in this one. So now, we've got some problems. Yeah.
That's a deliberate. These wars have been genetic wars. They have been to eradicate the strength of the human race in more of a way that, which is, again, not fully been completely studied or understood. We have to understand that. But do you see also, you know, at the before the break, I want people, whether they come to this link on your site or my site, I want them to reread it as you've been doing many times, because there's a subtextual, you know, first of all, when have you ever seen when have you ever heard a scientist of this kind of caliber do so much speculation into almost, you know, foreign territory than this? Doesn't it alarm you to see that, look, aren't these the very same people that if you sat down for 5 minutes, you know, 10 years ago and started to say even half of what this person's saying, they would have completely shut you up by saying, no speculations, we're scientists, where's the facts?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that's gone out the window. And here's this person pontificating, you know, getting into some very heavy speculation. And I think it's for a reason, because there is not just this is not just saying to us about the experiments itself in a scientific way. This is dropping a lot of stuff that has come from the research community, people like myself, Zachariah Sitchkin, Eric van Dyken, you know, the people who've been saying that this has, in fact, been going on. Look at where it's coming from now. I said on your show and many shows before that in the future, in the next 10 years, We are going to learn about the origins, you know, the secrets of our origins and all the mysteries that have been hidden from the human race. And look now what we're seeing, where it's literally being preached and broadcast from the top institutions in the world, the very things that yesterday they would have completely, hands down denied.
Right. I wonder what, you mentioned Eric von Daniken, and I wonder what Eric would say or what he did say when he saw this.
Oh, he's, I've had my uphill struggle. You know, it's nothing compared to what that man has had. For 25 years or whatever, the world laughed at him. The world ridiculed him. You know, and this is a man who lived in the video age. He literally took video cameras. Of course, now it's different. Now he's understood. You know, they've completely had to accept. But this man's endurance is something in itself to be marveled at. But he has taken photographs. He's literally shown. Underground caves that nothing on this earth could ever have carved into such a regular form that lasers must have been used. Graham Hancock has literally put on diving suits and dived to the bottom of oceans to show you whole underground cities. You know, there's not been a thing today that has not been shown to conclusively prove, and I believe that this tag-along science, which is what it has been, it has not been as progressive as people imagine. That's all the hype.
Mm-hmm.
What it has done, it has kept to a very old world, closed system, Einsteinian, Copernican, Darwinian lies for as long as those lies, Jeff, could sustain themselves.
It's amazing to me. Those lies are on life support, and they keep propping them up and pretending like they're viable, and they're not.
Right. No, they're not. And obviously we know the authors. Your program has hosted so many of them. We have a Richard Milton and Ellen and Dallaire. The list goes on now of the people within their own system, from the head of MIT and CIT, Max Flint and Otto Binder, who wrote Mankind, Child of the Stars, a book I constantly refer to in my work,
Mm-hmm.
These are the top brass of Oxford and Cambridge. So what do you do when you have people like that from within the system, going for broke and refuting all of these kinds of idioms? Well, then it causes uproar within the system. And the sum result is that it looks like they're going to become pretty redundant. So
sure.
Then that you see this kind of thing coming forward where they pretend to be radical. There's incredible statements in this. Look at one of the things that this character says, if I may quote. He says, indeed, ancient astronaut writers believe, and I suppose he means people like, our crowd here, the ancient astronaut writers,
mm-hmm.
they believe that a race of intelligent extraterrestrial beings visited and or colonized Earth in the remote past, whereupon they upgraded, now there's another talismanic word.
It is.
Right, which says, oh, but you weren't perfect before. Sorry, little human, you're a programmed machine, and, let us say that you were programmed, but of course you were programmed by sophisticated, higher intelligent people. Make no mistake about it, that before this visitation of our Nephilim masters, you were a bunch of troglodytes. Okay? So let's leave that aside. He says, upgraded the primitive hominid Homo erectus by means of genetic engineering to create the human race as we now know it, Homo sapiens. Okay? So it's, again, very loaded. But the idea is that some advanced people came here and programmed us like machines in order to make us into the criminal, unjust, maniacal creatures that we are today in this world.
Well, they either did it intentionally or it was an experiment that went terribly wrong, one or the other. Stand by, Michael. We'll pause and come right back in just a couple minutes. Michael Tsarian is our guest tonight. Always fascinating conversation when Michael is here. We are on the doorstep of some amazing developments in our worldview and our world view of ourselves. And yes, we're machines, and these machines can be corrected. They can be also programmed to do ill, which is Michael's point. We'll be back in just a minute or two. Don't go away. Michael Tsarian, who has electrified listeners on this program a number of times in the past and has Marvelous website. Okay, Michael, let's continue with this issue.
He goes on,
go ahead.
When he goes on the next paragraph, he said, evidence for this idea is found in the possibility of Homo sapien emerging so suddenly, okay, because they've always had that as a stumbling block. They've never been able to step aside that and never answer it coherently as to what on earth did this human being just do popping up out of the blue, you know.
Well, there's only, for you and I and other people who think, there's only one obvious answer, but go ahead.
Yes, exactly. Now, it says, according to the principles of Orthodox Darwinism, and B, in the myths of ancient civilizations which describe human-like gods coming down from the heavens and creating mankind in their own image. Homo sapien is thus regarded as a hybrid being, incorporating a mix of terrestrial genes from Homo erectus and extraterrestrial genes from an ascribed race of gods. So you can see that they're now, you know, jumping all over themselves. They're very, very infatuated with this idea that we've been talking about for you know, how many years now? All the way back to Zachariah Sitchin and to, you know, other writers who talked about the possibility that aliens were amongst us, quote unquote. And then you can take it even further back to that, to science fiction, Star Trek, Rod Serling, you know, the British Doctor Who. You know, this is not a new concept. This goes way back. But suddenly they're co-opting these theories of ours and trying to explain it in their own scientific way because the time is right for that. They need to come up with answers. But, you know, my eye always notices these particular little loaded statements, you know, that, again, hang on, you're questioning the visitors who came here who may have messed with our DNA, you know, but what was their DNA? Who messed with their DNA? You know, are they creatures of the light, or maybe are they creatures of darkness, you know? Who's to presume that they're already advanced? If people read through this, you're going to get that tonality that the subtext is that, of course, we were the less advanced primitive ones, scratching a meager living here, you know, chewing meat off the bone, right? And these were the advanced ones who came in here and did something marvelous, and then suddenly the pyramids got built, you know? So there's a whole bunch of other subtext here that one needs to be very, very cognizant of when they're reading these people's work.
Right, right, true. Okay, so where do we go next? What does this lead to?
Full circle. All of this so-called progress just takes us back to what the ancients knew originally. You know, Jordan, Maxwell, and I have always said, if you want to understand the world we're going to inherit, the world that we're in now, and the world of tomorrow, we must understand the world of the past. The other major criticism that I have about this kind of, you know, presentation where any kind of genetics is talked about from this character or any other is the mechanicalistic, left-brain mechanicalistic way that the very DNA itself, Jeff, is portrayed.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever it's portrayed as a graphic, it's always this Lego set type thing floating
exactly.
There in hyperspace.
Right.
Okay,
sure.
This is mega problems. You know, in corporate logos, you'll always see this. In TV, it's the common thing. So if a child is asked, you know, a young person, what's DNA? They immediately have this extremely erroneous idea. Mm-hmm. DNA is nothing more than an expression of vibration, an expression of number, an expression of language, expression of archetypal energetic form that the scientists of the world have chosen to portray in a very, very negative way. That's the first thing. In ancient times, both going through the Kabbalistic systems, which are originally were with the Celtic people, back through the shamanic tradition, you will always hear in mythology, it's one of the most common motifs of the spiral ladder, or just the ladder in general. The Masons use the symbol of the ladder ascending to heaven. You have Jacob dreaming of the ladder to going to heaven. In the Anasazi Indians and the Hopis, you see they always build houses in which have to be entered by a ladder. The ladder is a very big part of their mythology. You have the concept all over the world of the spiral ladder, you know, or the twin serpents or what have you. And this is the old idea that a human being has the ladder of life within them, you know, and that this thing does respond, as they now know, to photonic light. It does is programmable by language and by light and by sound and by vibration.
Oh, I absolutely think it's an antenna.
Yes.
I've always felt it. An antenna,
yes,
that's kind of
right.
It's a crude term, but that's what it does. I mean, I think it's reading all kinds of subtle energies from perhaps sources that we can't even imagine.
Right. Well, even the cell wall, the mitochondria, the DNA itself, it has receiver capabilities, and it also emits photonic light. So it not only receives, I mean, of course it must be a receiver because, you see, consciousness changes your DNA. The whole concept that the people who are off the grid and they're thinking know is that consciousness changes reality. Consciousness changes biology. I mean, you'd think that the scientists would be onto this, but apart from Bruce Lipton, perhaps, you know, and one or two others, they still haven't got around this concept yet. that 99.9% of your consciousness is unconsciousness, and the part you live your life with is so such a small, you know, quota, and that your DNA responds to your moods, responds to your fate, your mental shifts, and to other mental, psychological patterns, mm-hmm. that this thing is definitely a receiver. But the dark side of that, as you well know, is that there's a higher intelligence out there that knows that through harp waves and through microwaves and through frequency, you could be also programmed and taken down. And it's very interesting to note that, did you know that there's a quote in the Book of Enoch, which is a book that people like myself turn to a lot for the old story of this, not the new story, but the old story. In Enoch 14, it says, from henceforth, and he's talking about the coming of the gods and the interfering with the DNA, Enoch says that from henceforth you shall not ascend into heaven for all eternity. And in the bonds of the earth, the decree has gone forth, you will be binded, you know, or you'll be, you know, captured there for all the days of the world. And it's, this is a motif picked up in other books as well. But when in the dumbed-down state, after Zeus and the great gods have divided mankind, you know, and created this Homo Atlantean being, you are now not able to ascend into the heavens. And it's a, you know, it means it's in both senses of the word. It's not just that you're going to miss the technology. You're going to be dumbed down to a state where you won't have access to the technology of your fathers. But you are also not able to fly mentally, spiritually. The way that we, it's not, yeah, this character Chang, better understand, we were programmed, our DNA was messed with, but it was not for our benefit. Wait till, if these people can ever make that jump, is the jump that I make in the Atlantis book. Is it okay, even if this world is to get to the level, Jeff, of accepting that DNA was tampered with, which this article shows that the world is getting to that stage, well, then we have some mighty big questions about the kind of breach of sovereignty and the immorality of that act, and the fact that there's evil rampant in the world. We have a culture of total dumbed-downness and insanity.
There's evil rampant in the galaxy. There's evil rampant, perhaps, in the universe. We don't
know. Exactly. Well, the programming has not enabled us spiritually. It's actually held back our spiritual development. This is the message of the shaman tradition, which is in complete contradistinction to what the scientists are saying.
I agree. Agreed. Stand by. We'll do a little business, Michael. Come right back with more in just a couple minutes. Michael Tsarian is my guest tonight. Be right back. At some point, there's going to come a day of reckoning when science, as we know it, Michael, will have to face the music.
Yeah, good
and,
point, Jeff.
And deal with it. It's only a matter of time. In the meantime, however, we know science, of course, is beginning to play around with our genetic composition and the genetic composition of these so-called lower animal life forms on the planet. And, you know, the clock is ticking. I don't know if you share my view, but we know, I think, those of us who've studied this, that on the shelf right now are probably any number of microorganisms whose release of which could wipe out all life on the planet in short order. We know that. If the environment doesn't collapse and kill us all off, somebody, some lunatic in a laboratory could pull down the jar C-77 and turn it loose in a public water supply and stand back and laugh. You know, some deranged lunatic. That stuff exists. We know that. I know that two bacterial organisms have been identified and written about in the mainstream media, which, if they were to be turned loose on the planet, would in fact wipe out all plant life, one of them, and the other one would wipe out, I think it was all non-plant life, but I can't remember. But those were two doomsday organisms that were written about, and we both know there's a lot behind the curtain.
And if you buy into some of William Bromley's research, it wouldn't be the first time that this kind of thing has taken place.
And the book that I go back to again and again, which spells it out in a very dramatic way, is a book called A Canticle for Leibowitz.
Yeah, the Howard Smith, yeah, fantastic.
Which tracks the rise and self-destruction of this bipedal species over and over again throughout the millennia.
Magnificent book. And these doomsday things as well could be, again, a scenario of the blue pill, red pill situation in which they spread this disease and the whole planet gets it, and then they hand you the antidotes and say, ah, but there's a condition.
Yeah.
Okay, the ones who are going to survive, let's see the curriculum vitae here,
yep.
You know, of who survives and who doesn't survive, and of course then the human race, now that it's working from its R complex again, meaning the limbic structures, immediately becomes survival-oriented and then puts people like ourselves to the wall, perhaps, you know, who are free thinkers.
Sure.
So there's a fear base within a lot of people, and if this should happen, it would maximize that fear base to unbelievable heights.
Well, that limbic system would weed out any so-called aberrant thinkers like ourselves immediately.
Of course, immediately, because, you know, you're back to the survival thing. As a matter of fact, if you track it, and I'm sure you can see this, it's already becoming like that. For all the sophistication and the 25 kinds of ice cream and, you know, the more cable channels, for all this addition of the stimuli of the world, the human being, emotionally and spiritually, is actually moving closer and closer towards his limbic, you know, faculties again.
It's a very interesting point, and one need look no further than what they call sports over here in this country,
and
what they call war in the Middle East and elsewhere, and the butchery of countless millions in Africa by Africans, and so on and so forth. I mean, it goes on and on. Go ahead.
No, well, people better find out how these Africans who are poverty-stricken 1 minute suddenly turn up with tanks and guns and uniforms and all of the other, you know...
Of course.
Fax machines and telephone machines and armored trucks. How who funds all that? How do they suddenly manage to get all of that out of the blue, you know?
Same people that funded HIV, which was released in Africa, to wipe them out anyhow.
That's right. This decimation is well known to people in third world countries, you know, who don't have the luxuries we do. And this is one of the old scenarios in which they used fear with the idea of, you know, the nuclear bombs and fear of Russia. So they always have a fear device hanging over our heads.
Always.
But there are people who despise the human race who have always wanted to phase out the people of the world. And now the people of the world are literally overpopulating themselves to an extraordinary degree. You have to also understand, you know, the philosophy of these kinds of overlords. When people are, and I don't mean, you know, that it's unconscious. People are consciously want to remain in ignorance. And when they operate from this very primitive limbic realm, if you were one of the overlords, you would be considering what is the purpose of these slave units who, even when they're given an opportunity, they don't mind that the libraries are closed down in their area. They don't listen to the soothsayers and the thinkers who are waking them up.
Right.
You know, they don't take proper action when heinous murderers are going off in their name to kill and slaughter and murder women and children.
They don't do anything anymore.
They don't do anything anymore. So if you were one of these controllers, what we have to understand as well is that these, you know, Saurons, these dark lords, you know, feel perfectly justified in their thinking then to say, hey, let's maybe work on this campaign to phase these creatures out because they don't look too, you know, advanced to us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's a very, you know, sad situation. And we have been told, there's been many, many people who've been told, and I also think that the article that we're talking about here, it's a bit dangerous because, you see, by throwing a lot of this out there to bamboozle and to, you know, sort of intrigue the human race that, my goodness, this mysterious DNA has just all this magical properties. Oh, my goodness, what's going on? Who are we? What are we? You know, there's another agenda here, which is to sweeten the human race up for the tinkering that they want to be doing with the DNA by crossing, you know, all sorts of things. They've already had laws passed where they can, you know, in the stem cell research, they don't have to go to the animals. They can, in fact, use the human DNA.
Sure.
To do their experiments now, you know, some of these first experiments, so-called, in the public, you know, I mean, they've been done for hundreds of years, by the way, but, you know, that's a whole other story. They're now getting the public complicity to dabble because, of course, people are sick. People have terrible diseases, and we need to work with DNA to fix you. You know, there's no such thing as holistic therapies or consciousness changing your DNA and your biology. No. There's only the FDA and the AMA and these wonderful genetic scientists who want to tinker around and prod around in your DNA, because then they're going to fix your little problems. They're going to fix baldness, and they're going to fix, you know, alcoholism, you know, and they're going to fix autism. And just you sit there and wait for the wonderful day, the wonderful utopian, super streamlined scientific world where Dr. Daddy has it all worked out and there's no more disease in the world.
No.
You know, so this kind of thing has a double-edged sword as well. It's going, look at the advances we're making, world. We're on to the secret of life. We've cracked the code. It's not psychology. It's not spiritual development. And, hey, it's not even morality. It's DNA. We're just going to tinker around and switch here and turn this knob, you know, and pat ourselves on the back of what fantastic, you know, cooks we've been. And all sorts of, you know, evils will be eradicated from the world. Just keep funding the FDA and the AMA and the Genome Project, you know. There's a lot of this subtext going on that people need to be very, very wary of.
The article itself, for my money, it could have been a lot better.
Oh, of course.
I think the author did an okay job, but then he began invoking a lot of names and a lot of people who have been not in the center
of this. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. I don't want to get slinging stuff around here, but I think the article could have been about half as long, written in a very tense and strict journalistic breakthrough fashion, and let alone. But we start mentioning a lot of people in this article, and it does leave a lot of people kind of scratching their head and say, what's going on here? These two things don't necessarily match.
I mean, look around. When the media itself is regressing, the media has realized it's culpable for it in the first place, but it's also realized that you print anything from the Lancet or from the Smithsonian or from any other journal, you know, of science, and people, you've lost them within the first sentence. So these journalistic types who are not even that literate.
Well, they write like People magazine they're doing.
And this is what they want to, you know, do and to get it across. But I completely agree, you know, and I didn't have time to check. I've been so busy. Did you post that article on your site?
Yeah, okay, back on the 11th. It's up there.
Okay, and people can get to it by way of my blog. It'll be there on the Atlantis Genetics page, because it needs to be put into context. You know, articles like that, as you say, have a lot to be desired. And so, you know, I put it on my Atlantis page of the blog so people can read up other stuff and put it into context and get a real fix on what's going on here.
There's a hell of a story here in the beginning, and then it dissembles, and it starts running off into a lot of different areas, which I don't think serve it particularly well, but... Anyway,
right.
the point was quite clear that we do have a lot of DNA that is unusual, shall we put it that way?
Mm-hmm.
And your point about, when I go back to years and years and years ago, Dean Radin and so many others dealing in the world of consciousness studies, people like David John Oates dealing in the unconscious realms of things with reverse speech and other technologies, which
Absolutely.
Are extraordinary, and the whole idea of... And I think the most important word of the last decade, of the last millennium, was the term intent.
Yeah.
Intent.
Yeah.
That is so important to everything, and I think that word has a brilliant future if we last long enough, because intent, meaning thought, purity of heart, and all the rest of the things that Michael Tesarian has been talking about, are really at the very key to unlocking the mystery of why we suffer and why we are what we are. It's all about intent.
And I couldn't agree more, and my fingers have gone numb. You know, I think one of the key words that I've had to write, you know, with people when we're talking on the blog or on emails is the word attitude.
Attitude,
you know, and the people hitting me with their questions, which they have the perfect right to do, and it's great. And they're saying, oh, this is going on in my life, and, you know, this is crazy. Hey, Michael, what are we going to do about this? You know, and the key word really is attitude, attitude, attitude.
Mm-hmm.
Stop living in the past, you know, like a ghost.
Well, stop being a victim.
Like some ghoul haunting a graveyard, which is the memories of your past that are dead and gone and don't serve you. And stop living like some alien in this super lit, super technologized future, which also doesn't exist. Live right now, be yourself, speak your own mind, and be yourself, and change your attitude, which is the same thing as your intention. The intention is just focused attitude on a particular thing, and all sorts of miracles will take place. You know, can we not get the human race off the track of waiting for George Bush and the government and the system and the peers and the politicians and the priests to turn you on and give meaning to your life? You know, this compulsory, ubiquitous extroversion in which people sit around waiting for the television and the latest stimuli to give meaning to their lives. You give meaning to your life. The human being must turn themselves on. And this is a change in attitude is priceless. But, you know... There's things to inspire that change, like great music and great movies and great artwork.
They're wonderful things. And if only we as a species could remember what it is like to sit and be quiet for a few minutes each day and understand that the moment, that glorious moment, is almost everything. It's not last year, last what happened to me when I was a kid. Poor me, I'm dragging this baggage around all my life. It's not what's going to happen next year or 5 years from now. It's today.
You know, children also, if you observe any group of kids, you know, like on the train, you know, I do this all the time.
30 seconds, Michael.
Walking in the mall or something like that. They don't even have the space between two thoughts anymore before somebody else has chimed in on what they're thinking about. So the space between two thoughts in our culture has become too long a wait.
It's exactly. It's, as I've said so many times, it's a visual and auditory amphetamine world these kids live in. They cannot slow down. All right, stand by. We'll come back in just a few minutes after the top of the hour break with hour number two with Michael. All right, back with Michael Tesarian, hour number two of our conversation. Michael, the Internet has been a boon and a bane in so many ways. Certainly there have been a number of wonderful people who have come forward and put their work forward like yourself, and that work has been accepted by hungry minds eager to find direction and new understanding and certainly perspective of what we are and where we're going. But there have also been, unfortunately, a deluge of phonies, frauds, opportunists who are out there to deceive and corral as many disciples, as it were, as they can. For the newcomer to this field, and it is such an important one, how do we instruct people to be discerning, cognitive about what they're processing, not just reactive but proactive, and not proactive in an egocentric sense but in an honest, inquiring sense? It's not an easy task for a lot of people anymore, even though the information is extraordinary. It's become rather daunting at times.
It can be, and this is a subset of the whole thing you were talking about when it comes to intention and attitude. You know, we were talking earlier.
Right.
The thing to do is to fall in love with the action of questioning. Everyone questions, but very few people love it. You know,
and that's true, and that's not confronting in a hostile sense. That's questioning.
Yes, questioning and critiquing in the true first tense word meaning of these words. The human being has been given something, whether he's been tampered with genetically or not. The fact remains, and if it was good enough for Socrates and Plato, it's good enough for us. And that is that you are endowed with a thing called the human reason, and that human reason needs to be sharpened every single day. It is a golden sword, and it is not for cutting onions. It is for using in the right, virtuous way. And that means that, there's a plethora of information out there. Be happy that there's a plethora, because it's one of the positive symptoms of what I refer to in my work as the spirit of rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
That those voices, that cacophony, you may not like it, but philosophically speaking, it's a very, very good thing to have all of those voices and all of that diversity. What happens is you have to put it through the filter of the self. What people are waiting for, as far as others to come along and explain it in the didactic Saturnian way, that, of course, it was the habit of the past, where you're not the expert, you're the lowlife, we're going to come and educate you in this very linear, super rational way. The human being must love the questions. After 9/11, let's take 9/11 as an example. So many voices, so many orgs, so many, questioners and magazines and e-zines and stuff, and I love it. All of that, MySpace, YouTube generation, I look at as very, very positive because I know where it's heading. Yes, it's chaotic and so on, but the thing is that people run around going, I want to know, I've got questions. But here's my point that connects with the theme of attitude. All those questioners were coming, the motive of their question was fear, paranoia, anxiety, I'm not all right. How do I get back to the
mindless mediocrity of the sleep, the Newtonian sleep that I was in.
Right.
This is the, so it's not the problem of the diversity. It's the problem of the person approaching that matrix or that archive and the motive they have for their questioning. The person
and
who is a lover of wisdom and the person who loves the act of questioning will love the answers and will be able to discern what is true and what is false.
So many people want it handed to them, though. They don't want to do the work. They want to be told where it is, what's the truth, so I can embrace it.
Yes.
I'm home.
And that's unforgivable, because if you take the American metaphor, this what you're talking about is unforgivable to me. The old prospector, right, who goes out there with his mule, and he's going to take on a mountain. He's going to take up a whole landscape, you know, maybe running for hundreds of miles and prospect a river. He's got one pan in his hand. He's got to sift through all the, you know, the sand in order to get those few grains of sand gold, and then he'll have something precious in his hands that will be belong to him. It's the same thing in the sphere of knowledge and the sphere of the world. You have to go alone. You have to take your mule, and you got to trek out there, and you got to take on that mountain of knowledge. But you got to do it with love. You not ever see it as a chore, like so many other the domestic minutia stuff in which people are involved. They have to love the questioning.
Well, our young people, unfortunately, are being trained not to do that. They're being trained to accept, to float along, and to be essentially reactive. As I say, again, they do not go out and seek intellectual stimulation, many of them. They don't.
Well, Jeff,
they seek good times. They seek recreation. They seek friends, camaraderie, and peer approval. And
well, Jeff, how can you blame them? These are children who...
They don't know any better. You can't blame them.
Exactly. You see, these are people who've had their natural voice, their authentic, what is called the authentic voice, their own intelligence, completely, you know, turned off. These are people who were, their energies were never accepted.
No, they were stillborn in a way.
That's right. So then, if people keep telling you, be silent, the message is to you, you know nothing, you're an underling, you don't know anything, eventually that child does exactly that. It becomes numb.
That takes less and less time all the time because of the way the school systems have now been retooled to create this kind of submissive intellect. It's at best.
Right. Between 5 and 11 is the time when the child's natural intelligence is under attack. And therefore, between 11 and 18, which is the pubescent era, we meet what you're talking about. Well, what you're seeing there is a symptom. That is a creation of a world that is not interested in this person's free expression, this person's individuality. So he's not going to grow up to be another Wilhelm Reich. He's not going to grow up to be another Mozart. He's not going to be a man who says, hey, wait a minute, I think consciousness changes reality. Hey, I think consciousness even changes the weather.
He'll be a media-dependent wage slave, and that's the game.
It's incredible, and this is world-to-world what's happening now, and it's a symptom of turning off a person's natural intelligence by people who themselves are not in touch with their own authentic voice, dragging people out.
Right. The anesthetizing of hundreds of millions of people with the media is one of the most amazing things, I think, in recorded history. And you can call it mind control, propaganda, you can call it social engineering, I don't care what you call it, but it is the subversion of the human soul and spirit of independence and inquiry and adventure.
And somebody hit me with exactly that question of, hey, Michael, can you explain again how it is that the media, you know, messes with our minds? As if I was going to, on a blog comment, be able to explain this whole thing. I mean, Jesus. But I made a small point. I said, look, they're not talking to your conscious mind, buddy. You know, they're talking to your... They're dealing with heavy-duty occult symbolism. They have a complete profile of the human being's limbic system, his emotional and sexual drives.
You got it.
An aspect of your psyche. In fact, you know next to nothing about who you are, what your brain is, how consciousness works, the Jungian four types, the Freudian model of the mind. These characters know it right down to the bare bones. It's their daily bread. And they create these images and these erotic and aesthetic images to mess with your unconscious mind, buddy. It's not about, you know, I was telling this person, your choice of whether, you know, you should drink Coke or you should drink Pepsi. The item is not the question here, and your preference is not the issue here. It's your what they're telling you on a much deeper ancestral level that's changing the whole way that you relate to life, the way you relate to yourself, and the way you relate to other people and the world, and the way you relate to truth.
They're taking people back to their primitive selves with design and malice aforethought. And they're also using everything Michael has mentioned, but they're using, I've mentioned this many times, they're using supercomputer models. They know how to do this. It's all done electromagnetically. And what we watch on television is not all that's being put into our minds. And I try not to watch television. I don't have it, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
They have embedded and folded and impregnated those signals with all kinds of technologies that are utterly unlimited and unknown by 99.9% of the world. And that's
unless
the way
you
they
check
do the
into
game.
It. Yeah, unless you check into it and see the patents
right.
and see the co-opted, Russia was, while America was, thinking of itself as being puritanical and not wanting to mess with the DNA. Yeah, what do you think the Russian guys were doing over there? These are the ones who are testing the DNA with frequency, wave, EMF.
They were
EMF
25 years ahead of us. We were playing catch-up since the 1970s.
With Rothschild money and with complicity from the British Crown and many American capitalists, they're already hell-bent for leather over there, working on how to program the machine on a biological cellular level, and through so many different modalities that it's too long to get into right now.
Well, I believe, and I've said this before, of course. And who was it on the program that first brought this up? Pat Flanagan, the scientist,
right.
Patrick Flanagan. You
absolutely.
Know, Pat. All right,
oh,
Patrick.
Yes.
Patrick tells the story. There's a specific wave. It's a waveform. It's called a Lilly wave. And he was over at someone's house. I can't remember who now. And Patrick told the story here a couple of times. He said he was looking at a screen at this guy's laboratory, and on this screen, it was like an oscilloscope kind of a thing, was this Lilly wave, and it's an unusual form. And Patrick asked him, he said, "Well, what's the Lilly wave doing on your screen? Why are you watching that?" And he said, "It's coming through my house current."
Yeah.
And Patrick said, "What?" The guy said, "It's in the power grid." Okay. Now imagine all of you out there that you're living in an electromagnetic box, which is exactly what you're living in. You're surrounded with 60 hertz cabling throughout the house, 110 volts. The power grid at any point can be injected with all kinds of electromagnetic fields, resonances, harmonics, which will then go right down the street, around the corner, into your house, and surround you 24/7 through your wiring in that house. And believe me, they have means of creating disease, they have means of creating thought, anxiety states, emotional states, sexual states, you name it. They can do anything they want. I'm not saying they're doing it all the time, but that technology is quite real.
Absolutely. Absolutely agree with that.
All right, stand by, my friend. We'll take a break. Come right back in just a couple minutes. So think about that. What an amazing tool to deliver obedience electromagnetic training. The power grid into your home, into every building that we constantly inhabit. That's why you feel so good when you go out walking away from things and get your feet on the ground, because you're grounding not to the electromagnetic power grid and all the crap in it, but you're grounding to the Earth's natural resonant magnetic field, which is only 10% of what it was 4,000 years ago. So think about that too. Back in a minute. With Michael Tesarian. It's all about diversion, friends. There are many techniques being used on you all the time, and you'll be the last to know it in most cases. Although this audience, you dear people, of course, whom I consider to be the brightest in all of talk radio, maybe in talk radio history, know much of this. It's the walking masses that don't, and I feel so helpless around them, Michael. You know, it's
they need to find out. You know, they need to get into Jim Keefe. One of the greatest scholars on American shores, who of course was removed.
Well, I had one of Jim's friends on just a couple of days ago, Jerry E. Smith, who went
That's
to high
it,
school
exactly.
with him, and
Jerry has endorsed the Atlantis book, and he and I are good friends. In fact, I have a quote from that very book. The concept that you're talking about is called entrainment, which some kind of devising. Our super technology can be used to affect behavior. And one of the quotes from his book, he says, I always have this quote at hand, it's fantastic. He says, could you control people if you could project holographic images into the sky, pictures of gods that they worship or of the demons that they fear the most?
That was Project Bluebeam.
Bluebeam, huh?
That's what it was called, the original plan for that. Yeah, imagine... Buddha in the sky over China. Imagine Muhammad over the skies over the Middle East. I mean, you know, Christ over Western Europe and the Americas, looking as real as possible with it. Amazing.
Some new Messiah figure.
Whatever.
Leading the Jews to, you know, to their heaven.
Exactly. Heaven. I mean, that was one thing that was actually apparently an actively promoted concept of mass mind control and entrainment, engineering, and all the rest of it in the 70s. It wasn't
unbelievable.
Used.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, well, they've got technology that's 20 years ahead of what we can imagine.
In the 2012 DVD that I have, I also turn it around because I'm a Reichian. I'm very much a believer in the theories of Wilhelm Reich. And I also look at the flip side of it, is that what makes a person susceptible to this kind of control? Because it's a two-way street here. If a person is not clean and not healthy and not connected to nature, as you were just saying, and they don't have their bliss, their satori, then you are more liable to be a person who will respond even to low levels of this kind of manipulation.
It's like an open door for them to walk right in and take charge of you.
Right.
Sure.
So somebody will go, hey, wait a minute, there's no, you know, it's okay, we granted, there's, you know, some kind of control, but it's not that heavy. Well, listen, it doesn't need to be heavy if you are yourself in a completely, you know, alien state of being and disabled mentally and spiritually and morally. It doesn't need to be that heavy or thick.
No, it doesn't.
To mess with your mind, you know?
That's right. No, it's easy pickings for them. And I see our young people now. I see our intelligent young people playing on the computer game circuit. They play on the internet now. Hundreds of thousands of them can play the same game at the same time on the internet.
Yeah.
It's going into a virtual reality. Pretty soon, the virtual world for most people will be the real world. And the virtual world for them will be the world that we're talking about.
Right, no doubt about it. And that's a very comfortable world, because then you don't have to deal with all those troublesome emotions,
right,
which cause people to do some real homework.
Exactly.
You don't have to fall in love with the question. Hey, you don't have to question at all. You just think with the collective brain of the cyber age, cyberspace, with all these other people, with their opinions, and you go with that. And if you look in the eyes of most young people today, you don't see a soul, Jeff. You don't see a person in there anymore.
Oh, my. You've just said something that was brought up on the program recently again, and John Hogue did it. He said something that I've been noticing, and obviously you have too, for a long time. You go out among masses of people. Not only do you not see things when you look in their faces and their eyes, but you don't feel or sense things. If you're a sensing, feeling person, it's as if they don't have souls. And I've felt that was a viable possibility for a long, long time. And John said it, it just caught me flat-footed. He said there are a lot of people who do not have souls. In fact, he said the majority don't. And
that's
he
right.
said, and he explained it in a very deft and credible fashion. He said, yes, they have the soul seed, but it has not sprouted and grown at all.
Right. And, you know, this goes back to the psychology of Thomas Sasse, who said basically that soul is not something that is given to you. The soul is not something that you are given by God. It's something that you create. It's not something you find. It's not something given to you by
Jesus. How do you create it when you've been anesthetized into a hive of virtual reality?
Right. From the moment that you popped out into those sick, you know, pain factories, the hospitals, you know, run by the Knights Templars, they have completely made sure that you're going to be so injected and so traumatized through this, you know, I don't know what, the whole malarkey of the hospitals with the circumcisions and the injections and
and 35 to 40 vaccinations for the average California child now before they're even 12 years of age.
My God Almighty! And then, you know, just the fluorescence, and then they chuck you out into this place of unbelievable madness and chaos. So the child grows up and it doesn't realize. Remember, as I said, it's people waiting for the world to turn them on, and if the internet provides that better than television, hey, they jump right over into that place, because it's not about you giving meaning to your life or resonating with the roots of the earth or the ancient way. It is about, you know, Big Brother in some form or fashion turning you on, just exactly like a programmable, you know, machine. This is the problem.
And with those poor folks whose souls have not grown, who are in seed state, as John Hogue pointed out, however you want to look at it, they are empty vessels in so many ways, Michael. The potential is there, but this society, this Big Brother organization, this cabal of evil and dark does not want those souls to grow. Yeah. They want them to remain where they are. And right. I walk amongst them, and I feel the sea of emptiness. Once in a while, a light comes on, and you know it when someone comes around you. You sense it. And many of you out there listening sense it.
And otherwise, it's an abyss. It's an abyss of mediocrity and dumbed-downness, and you do have a few gems walking around in the middle of that. And like you say, you do, you know, it's very refreshing to meet those kinds of people.
It is. And then you've got to watch out for the vampires, because they're out there too, and they'll take from you.
Yep.
Hold on.
The soulless ones.
Indeed. Back in just a few minutes. Conversation with Michael Tsarian tonight, whose work continues nonstop. Michael, what are you working on right now? What's the big push?
Well, the DVDs was a project, you know, the Origins and Oracles series was a 2 to 3 year, hard, intense, every day, pretty much a monstrous project. And
I don't know how you did it. I don't know how I did it. Yeah.
I don't know how I did it. You know, it's that part is a complete mystery. I mean, you know, there's no accounting for that. You work on a quantum level. When the muse comes in, it does the work, sort of, and you're just like tagging along somewhere in the middle of all of that. But it's been good to take a bit of a break from that and, you know, just focus now on the Irish Origins of Civilization book. You know, people can go to irishoriginsbook.com and check that out, or go to michaeltsarian.com and click through to that website and see what's going on there. Because, you know, this is basically the supplemental work to the Atlantis book, which stipulated the fact that there was these wars of the gods, that this DNA, the stuff we've been talking about, is hardly anything new. It's 50,000 years old is when the major, you know, the major intervention into our biology was done, and that this was done in the continents of Atlantis and Lemuria. So the Irish Origins book basically is, you know, to then show that, okay, those continents don't exist anymore, but what happened to the Atlanteans? What happened to the Lemurians? What happened? Where did they go? And the most controversial aspect of this book, just as the controversial part of the Atlantis book, as you know, Jeff, was to point out what is the problem of evil. How did the problem of evil come into the world? Well, the controversial aspect of the Irish Origins book is about the fallacy of the east-to-west movement of the elements of civilization. This is a book that I'm hoping to kickstart, you know, the whole reanalysis of the concepts of the Arya. The Irish, the original Irish, it wasn't with an I, a capital I, it was with a capital A, the Arya or the Aryan. Now, of course, that word's a loaded word that has been so abused in modern times.
Oh, has it ever.
Right? But the true Arya, as is well known to those people at the top who've been unleashing this propaganda mythology, are the noble ones. It didn't refer to it didn't refer to race as much as it did to moral and spiritual superiority. It referred to the Druids and the shamanic traditions of the world. But the Druidic order from Ireland, as we said on a previous program, extended, you know, from Ireland and Britain, and there was a landmass at that time into Europe, so it was very easy. Mm-hmm. Up until 3,000 years ago, or probably even sooner, there was a very substantial landmass bridge that crossed over into Europe. It was all one. England and Europe were connected. And so there was a vast, early, very, very primordial, prehistoric migrations of extremely advanced people into Syria, into the land of the Amorites, into Babylon, and into Egypt. And it is the seeding through Europe and into Asia of the Arya, the noble ones, the fair-haired, blonde, you know, intelligent ones who worshipped the sun and brought culture. This is what I'm going into. So it's and I'm tunnel-visioned on that book, and I should be able to get you your first copies of it, Jeff, but probably I'm hoping by the late spring at the latest.
Wow.
Because things are flying ahead, and it's going full guns, and should have that book out by, you know, April, May.
I look forward to it. Geological evidence to sustain the breakup of some kind of a land bridge?
Yeah, this is recently begun into a fantastic book. I hope you can get this man on your show. Is Ulf Erlikson, who wrote a book called Atlantis in Ireland.
Hmm. Or
it's also entitled Atlantis from a Geographer's Perspective.
Hmm.
People can find this book on my site linked, you know, or they can go to Amazon and put in Atlantis in Ireland or Atlantis, a Geographer's Perspective, and he will talk a lot about the land bridge. So there's no end to this, you know. In fact, it was there 3,000 years ago.
Hmm.
Now, what this does is it's very, very important for actually for Scotland, because when anyone who's done any work on the megalithic sites points to northern Scotland and Argyllshire, and especially the Orkney Islands or the Outer Hebrides, people just cross their arms and go, those places were so remote. Who could have been living up here? You know, this is it. Because, of course, those places are remote now, yeah. But see, if there was a land bridge which almost, you know, connected to northern England, all the way from southern England to northern England to where Scotland begins,
uh-huh.
if that was connected to Europe, then suddenly the Orkney
right.
Islands and these, you know, very, very, the highlands of Scotland no longer appear to be something that is cut off and remote. Hey, they're next door. And
sure
so
they
therefore they could easily house Celtic groups of a great sophistication building these fantastic monuments. And, you know, do you know that there's serpent mounds up there that are 600 miles long?
No.
There's a 300-mile-long serpent mound. You know, these discoveries are coming to light all the time. It's almost identical to the one that is the famous one in Ohio. It's almost identical to the one that is in Avebury. These great serpent mounds have been discovered in northern Scotland. As I said, this Pajaric person, this chieftain has been discovered, this king, recently in northern Russia. There's no end to the discoveries that they're making. All of these kinds of finds of the Celtic Druidic people who were migrating. And, of course, the main problem is that the focus has been on east-to-west migrations of a later date, but
mm-hmm.
history starts there. So it's the same fallacy that you have when history itself was said to have started 7 to 11,000 years ago. I mean, we're not just talking about some pathetic little, you know, migrations of tribes. The academia, the world believed that history itself, mankind's own development, began only 10,000 years ago.
We do know that something major happened 10 to 12,000 years ago.
Yeah.
I don't know the exact. A cataclysm, an asteroid meteor, we don't know. Something big happened.
Well, you know, to me it was the war of the gods that precipitated these tremendous earth changes. The earth changes were in two forms, the flood, of course, which is known to all mythologies, and the War of the Gods. And combined, those combined, was the tragedies that caused what scientists are discovering in the fossil record. You know something I want to draw people's attention to two incredible movies. Not that the movies themselves are great, but for the whistleblowing elements that are in the movies.
Okay.
One is The Day After Tomorrow, that's that Cataclysm movie.
Uh-huh.
I want people to get that out again and watch it, because would you believe it, that movie does not corroborate the old-school traditions of climatology. Believe it or not, the head character in that, who's meant to be a climatologist who works for the government, is actually dropping the theories of people like Allen and Dallaire and the more modern alternative people who talk about that there was no such thing as an ice age. It was superheating of the earth through volcanic and volcanism that then precipitated cold periods. I couldn't believe my ears that this is a whistleblowing movie that doesn't even buy into the official, Smithsonian, whatever you want to call it,
mm-hmm.
Concept. So that was a curious thing that even in mainstream movies now, in which millions of dollars are being spent, there's some people out there even have the guts to even deal with some of the most controversial latest discoveries that are right off the academic grid. That was one that was interesting.
All right, hold on. We'll do the other one right after this break.
Okay.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, interesting film, just for that kind of
very, very
content.
Good perspective to carry in viewing it. Indeed,
The other good part of it is that they burn all the law books.
Ah, I remember that. Yes, stand by. We'll be right back with Michael Tesorian in just a couple minutes. Glad you're along tonight. Don't forget to visit us at rents.com around the clock for news from around the world for you. Okay, back with Michael Tesori and talking about motion pictures here toward the end of our conversation tonight. Let's hear the second one. By the way, the number of quality motion pictures coming out now, it's no big surprise. I don't go to many films, but I don't know about you, Michael, but there aren't many I really even want to go to. But
No, of course not.
Let's hear your second.
I mean, even these movies, I'm mentioning not so much for their, you know, wonderful...
Their substance, but I understand.
Yeah.
Let me say one thing about films, and then I want to hear your second comment. When all of you go to films out there, motion pictures, movies, whatever you want to call them, you sit in the theater, watch carefully if it's a comedy, how the audience reacts. They are now trained, most of them, when to laugh, at what to laugh, how hard to laugh, how long to laugh.
Wow.
It's pretty damn scary. And most of the things that pass for humor now aren't humorous at all. And there are no laugh tracks. These are people laughing. So I remember the first time I saw a television sitcom many years ago in college, and I noticed that the laughter was clearly canned. And I said, uh-oh, we're headed for trouble here. They're telling me what's funny and what to laugh at on television. And I didn't like that. Anyway, it's gone downhill, and that was, you know, what, a long time ago. But go ahead, Michael.
Well, I couldn't agree more. This is, you know, again, it's not so hard to look around if you have the eyes to see these collectivist factors, the herd mentality, and what you've described is very, very key. The other one was brought to my attention by my brother. I was visiting him in Ireland, and he's a big believer in the work that I'm doing on the Irish origins. And he said, hey, have you ever seen the movie Alexander? It came out after The Gladiator, and it was a movie that was done by Oliver Stone and co. I said, no, you know, I'm like you. I responded basically, what you just said is like, don't bother me with these stupid-ass movies, you know. I don't watch them. He goes, you better watch this one because it's kind of interesting because it shows that the Macedonians, and this is peculiar because whoever chose the cast, do you know that all the cast are speaking with Irish accents?
No, I didn't know. I don't know anything about the movie.
It's the most bizarre thing there is. That the movie's meant to be about Alexander the Great and his life and his times and all this, you know, stuff he got into with conquering different places. But this whole thing is going along, and it's an interesting, you know, take on Alexander. But then there's this other phenomena where him, his father, all his main, you know, generals, and the majority of the cast, who are these Macedonians, interestingly, are speaking with Irish accents.
Coincidence? Or is Stone trying to tell us something?
Is Stone trying to tell? Because believe me, this is not just he's picked Irish actors, you know, who've all just walked into his office one day and the casting director.
Yeah, it doesn't work. Irish actors around.
Well, here's the other thing. Some of these actors are not Irish, but they're speaking with Irish accents.
Oh, really?
They're putting it on. They've been told to speak with a lilt.
Well, that's strange.
How about that?
That's
very
wild.
Very unusual. So we are being slowly fed information, you know. Of course, I'm not talking about the downloading of massive spiritual information like would be in a movie like Lord of the Rings, which is, you know, a completely different ballgame here.
Right.
But even in the rubbish that they're putting out of Hollywood, in certain movies like The Day After Tomorrow, you know, Underworld, which is another one if you can stand that, but, you know, it has interesting motifs. It's the old thing that James Bond movies of the past, you know, where they were dropping the hints right up to the modern day. You know, the world is not enough. You know, that's a major Masonic... Like the movie that James Bond, you know, The World Is Not Enough. This is a very large Masonic statement, which is in the mind of these one-worlders. So we're getting these motifs, you know. We're getting these motifs.
Well, the motion picture is probably the ultimate vehicle of our age for doing that kind of thing.
Yeah. Back to the days of Lenin and, Eisenstein, where they knew that this was the ultimate mind control.
Sergei Eisenstein. He understood it, he knew it, and they used it, and
Now, if people wanted to tell people, I suddenly realized that the Irish Origins site, the Irish Origins book, is a preview site, so people can go and see what's happening with the book. But if they want to read excerpts of the book, they can do that online at the Taroscopes website. So if they go to my Taroscopes website and click on the astrotheology pages, you will see on those pages excerpts of the coming books, because I'm putting excerpts up there for people. And you can get to taroscopes.com by going to michaeltesorian.com. So if you haven't time to write down Michael, haven't people got time to write down or spell taroscopes.com, then just remember my name, Michael Tesorian, and you can, it's a a menu site we have to get to all these other websites that I have. Just go to michaeltessarian.com, and that'll take you to all the other websites.
And Taroscope is T-A-R-O, scope, taroscopes.com.
Yeah, exactly, but you know, you never believe it. People can't write that down or remember it. So.
Oh, yeah, I do believe
it. But if you go to Taroscopes and then click on the astrotheology pages, then you will see excerpts of the Irish Origins book, because that's a concept that has to be put into context so that people understand what I'm doing there and not get all reactive and defensive, you know, about when we're talking in brief about it. You know, they need to understand that there's been a massive cover-up here, dating from the earliest times, to make it appear that the civilizing elements of the world have come from the desert wastelands of the East, and this is not true. There's been a whole other primordial movement of very sophisticated tribes and men of light and men of power from the West.
What is science saying about the blue-eyed blondes and redheads being found in utterly incongruous locations now?
Well, they're not saying much about it, and because they're so shocked, you see, because remember, who are these scientists? These are the people brought up, these anthropologists, paleontologists, and archaeologists. Unfortunately, they themselves are dependent on their masters, and they're also brought up from the old school system. So when they take their PhDs and go out digging around in the Tarim Basin, or in northern India, or in northern Russia, the steppes, or near the Kurgans of the Ukraine, and they dig up this stuff that's Celtic, that's proto-Celtic, they're stumped. They got to rewrite the whole of history.
So they just leave it alone. They just don't talk about it.
Yeah, they just go, anomaly. Anomaly. Well, anomaly? The Druids are somehow now an anomaly? As people will see, if people go to the excerpts I've got on the book, they will see that the Bible itself is loaded with Druidic symbolism. The Vatican is loaded with Druidic symbolism. Masons are basically the new keepers, not that they have authority to do it. They raped the knowledge of the Druidic colleges by way of the Roman army and other assaults upon Ireland and Britain. And then they are now the keepers of the wisdom of the Druids, re-spray-painted up as Templarism, Masonry, and so forth and so on. You know, this is Atonism from the old Egyptian cults.
A-T-O-N, Atonism. In 325 at Nicaea, how much of this was shaken down at that time?
Well, 50 books were left out, 4 remain.
50?
And not only that... The guy, the Constantine, who's this megalomaniac, he basically slaughters everybody right there. He had guards that surrounded the conference. Guards ushered you in and ushers you out.
Dead men tell no tales.
Yeah, and even during the discussion, if you adamantly withstood what the consensus was, the guards were told to just, you know, basically behead you right there, take you out in the hallway and kill you. This is your famous Christian Council of Nicaea. The next year from that, or I think it was even the same year, don't quote me on this, but it's either the same year or the next year, that Constantine murdered his own son and his own wife. The same year he initiated the so-called ever-so-holy Council of Nicaea. Yeah. He murdered
50,
his own...
50 books left out.
50 books left out. And then the rest that were left were, you know, badly put together, a hodgepodge, because uncanonical. They just go, this is uncanonical. Because any books that talk about the true meaning of the serpent, you see, in the Garden of Eden story, or the role of the female, for instance, which is very, very important, the Gnostic tradition, the Essenic tradition, any breakaway sect, any of the, you know, the Stoics, the people that we know as the Stoics? Stoicism and Christianity are so identical that a lot of scholars are even thinking that Stoicism, more than Egyptology, was the bedrock of the Christian movement. The Stoical books were all removed. The Stoics were killed, massacred, and suppressed. You know, we know about them a little bit from Rome. But the movement of the Stoics was eradicated by the Roman movement, because they knew that if the Druids or the Stoics or the Shaman, you see, and the Gnostics, and these breakaway Judaic sects, if they were to exist, you'd have you wouldn't be able to create this monstrous, you know, a religion that is now preying over the minds of men. You'd have a more human, you know, concept.
That's remarkable.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Tony Bushby is a great author I recommend.
Tried to get Tony on the program for several years now, and he's...
Well,
he's,
I hope you can, because I use his work a lot. I definitely refer to his work extensively. He is a man who wrote the book The Bible Fraud, which is, you know, I always recommend that if people are going to read my Atlantis book, they should always have in their other hand William Bramley's Gods of Eden. And I say that if people are going to read the Irish Origins book, you know, better have Tony Bushby's work on their table as well, because this man helps. You know, we don't agree on everything, but, you know, we got a lot of different stuff going on.
He's a brilliant man, and Bramley's book is really a classic, and we need to kind of, I wish they'd reprint it and relaunch it for a whole new generation.
Well, Jeff, I have a question. Have you had anyone on the show yet who's, you know, been in the school of the Anatoly Fomenko type of school?
No.
Anatoly Fomenko is the Russian, you know, scientist who's basically got a new chronology of our history that's basically saying that even the Dark Ages and certain periods of history may have been concoctions. They may not have even existed.
Really?
Yeah, we should maybe do a show on that in the future, or at least try to get somebody on.
Well, let's if you have time, let's you and I do it, or maybe even try and get him on, whatever. But
yeah.
You're invited. Let's
explore
that.
I'll send you information on these characters because he wrote. This guy is a scientist who's now, you know, shooting cannonballs through the whole of the biblical chronology and even history, even regular historical chronology, saying that whole periods of our history may not even have existed. He wrote the book History, Fiction, or Science.
Wouldn't
his name
surprise
is Anatoly.
Me.
Yeah, Anatoly Fomenko is a. People can come onto my website and see stuff. They've got their own website, of course. And just another, you know, like I said in the Atlantis book, we're living in the age in which so many revelations are going to be made. The only missing ingredient is whether you have an open mind to accept all of these revelations. And unfortunately, the human race is looking like it may not have that kind of an open mind, despite all the credible revelations that are being brought forth right now.
All too true, Michael. Another wonderful time talking about these things with you. Thank you. Rest well, and I'll look forward to our next get-together. You let me know when the time is right, and we'll do it.
Thank you, Jeff. Same to you. Absolutely. Have a great, hope the year goes great, and we'll talk again soon.
Okay, Michael. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Michael Tsarian. And there's another conversation for the books. We're going to pause, and we will be right back with you in 21 hours.